Welcome to everybody. Welcome, I'm Rob Olson, welcome to Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm Rob Olson, board member of the group, and thanks to everyone for coming out. We have several mission statements at Dallas Philosophers Forum. One of them being to make philosophy and ideas accessible to the general layperson and to promote philosophy amongst a broad and varied audience. In addition, we also like to expose people to topics beyond philosophy. In the future, we'll have some topics on history with a philosophical twist, on theology with a philosophical twist. And we meet, as you know, the second fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. Do we have any first-time visitors? Okay. What is your name, sir?
Tom Timmons.
Tom Timmons. Welcome, Tom. Any other first-time visitors? Okay, well, welcome to everyone. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Our treasurer, Jack Youngkin. Jack, you raise your hand. You can go ahead and pay him. The cost is $5. Students with an ID can attend for $2. And if you want the best bargain in town, the cost is $35 for 6 months. Also, I want to remind you to pay for your meal and your drinks as you leave, if you haven't already. We're a non-profit organization, and every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay, and then we'll end up with a tab. So please make sure you pay for your meal as you leave. We also have a website that has a lot of this information. It's www.philosophersforum.org, and you can sign up for our email. You can look it over our website. There's FAQs on the website. And so, please go ahead and share that with your family and friends as well. Now I ask that you please turn off your cell phones, and we'll put them on vibrate mode. And I'd like now to introduce our speaker. Dr. Gwynne Galbraith has a varied and interesting background. He graduated with a B.S. in philosophy. He started out with a B.S. in physics, and you decided to migrate from physics only to physics and philosophy from MIT. I think I've heard of that school. Subsequently, you acquired a master's degree in theology from Wesleyan Seminary in Holland, Michigan. You served as an assistant manager in the Second Reformed Church in Tarrytown, New York. Then you went to Pittsburgh to study in a new joint program at the University of Pittsburgh at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, where he earned a doctorate in three disciplines: philosophy, history, and philosophy of science, and theology. He became professor and acting chairperson of three departments: philosophy, history, and the philosophy of science and religious studies at a regional campus of the University of Pittsburgh. And later you went into the computer science field. So he's got a varied background. His topic today is God Talk. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Gwynne Galbraith.
Is the light on?
No, I meant this.
Yes, it's on.
Okay, thanks. Now this is on.
Oh, wow.
Hello. I've got too much material, actually, so I'm going to have to go fast through some of this and skip some of it as I go. Paragraph that described the talk tonight, there was reference to a quote from John Carroll, whom I really know nothing about. But he said that the challenge for the West is to rediscover religious language that speaks plausibly to the modern secular individual. And I think that I have a start on that. It's also quite common to hear things like, the question of our time is how to relate science and religion.
Do you need a light? Is your light? You
have enough light? No, I've got enough light on. I think that it would be obvious that that's what I'm doing here. Although I'm only limiting myself to one major concept, the concept of God. In the first part of what I go over, I'm trying to give you a feeling for what I call construmentalism. Some of you already know what I mean by that. If you don't, it's a variation of instrumentalism. I understand that I can't get outside my own mind to check on how things really are, other than the way I can see them, just to see if how I can see them is how they really are. So all that I have access to is the phenomena. I can't prove the concepts that I use. I can't prove the theories that I use. But I do make use of them, and if they're useful, then I like them, and I will, you know, suggest that other people use them, etc. I've asked for a copy of this to be passed out. I don't have enough of these things. I just brought along six or seven of them. This is a central slide in the presentation, and we'll come to it eventually. there we go. With reference to terms in general, meaning is constrained from two major sources. One is that my society provides a language where terms have multiple ranges of meaning. I'll give you an example in a second. The way that I know what these terms are and what they mean is I have a dictionary. And we teach people how to speak, you know, using that kind of information. I also am constrained by attempting to communicate something specific to somebody, maybe even myself. And when I do that, I can't say, well, look, what I mean is on page 68 of the dictionary, in the first column. I can't do that. I've got to somehow make use of these terms to try to communicate something specific that is not necessarily built into the terms. And I may run into problems if the terms, or the way I want to use the term and what it commonly means, don't overlap. That's a common issue, a common problem. Now, the meanings are not really totally preset, but they vary within a range for each context that they might be used in. And so there is some flexibility here. I have choice in which terms I use and what elements of those terms. It's not only a denotation for the term, there is a connotation, and that connotation is somewhat flexible, fortunately.
You have to aim it at the computer.
Oh, yes. It worked anyway. Thanks.
Okay.
It's very sensitive. So, for example, if I talk about runs, I might mean one thing in baseball, another thing if we're talking about nylons, another thing if it's scientific lab results, etc. I'm just going to flip past that. By the way, there is in the www.philosophersforum.com a presentation, a paper, which covers the same material. And some of it will be much more detailed than what I'm presenting tonight. So a couple of additional requirements for meaning. The terms have to be imaginable. For example, when we thought of the world as a flat rectangle in space, maybe on the back of an elephant, on the back of a turtle, on the back of another turtle, etc., it made sense to talk about corners of the Earth. But when we think of the Earth as a sphere in space, corner of the Earth doesn't really make sense. Corner of a circle doesn't make sense. Intellectual development of a quark doesn't make sense. Unless, of course, you're talking about Deep Space Nine, where we have a quark who does have intellectual development. If the concepts are intended to describe something real, then they have to be tied to our experiences. For example, atoms, which we never see, but which are tied to our experiences by our theoretical constructs which use those terms. Another example of that is dragons that attempt to swallow the sun and moon at eclipses. And you can ask, well, what about the supernatural? Does it make sense to talk about the supernatural? And my conclusion is it does not. I understand why people might want to talk about the supernatural, because you've got this plane of natural phenomena. And you can use all kinds of concepts to describe what happens in that plane of the natural phenomena. But sometimes you don't know what causes things to happen. And so you can invent another plane above the natural plane called the supernatural plane. And up there are these entities which somehow interfere with what goes on in the natural plane. And so those are supernatural invasions into the natural plane. I don't like this because I don't know what supernatural means. It doesn't tie to my experiences. And I have yet to come across a definition or an exposition which shows me how to make sense of that concept. So I propose to be construmentalist in my approach. And by this I mean that I choose, usually automatically. There's a recent book out by Kahneman where he talks about thinking fast and slow. Most of what we do when we think that we're thinking is very fast thought. It's stereotypical, it's automatic, and it's frequently wrong. But that's the way we think. It's automatic. I pick certain concepts, who knows why, and I attempt to construe my experiences in a way that I hope will be useful. And to a significant extent, my mind dictates what I perceive. And the same is true for everybody else's mind. I keep pointing away, it works.
That would be cool.
If I'm right, I can't prove it, by the way. Obviously, because if I could prove it, then it wouldn't be construmentalist. Are we just playing with terms? And I know some people will say that I'm just playing with the concept of God. And I'm sympathetic to that idea. There was a book some time ago called Homo Ludens, Man the Playing. And yes, we do play with things. But this is a serious play. I'm suggesting that people who don't know what they mean, or who didn't know what they meant, do, in fact, mean something. And this is it. And this is empirical, basically, or at least empirical in the sense that it ties to our experience. And I think this path will allow theists and non-theists to communicate. And one can say, well, why bother? You know, well, we do live together. As Kermit said a while back, they vote. So it makes sense for us to try to communicate to each other.
Finish reading it. Go back
for a second. Nah, I'll catch you later. here's a nice picture. Look at this and see what you think is going on. Okay? When I look at it, I see a man dressed in, and I construe that to be a swimsuit, not a towel. But I know something about this picture. You see these cables crossing the seam here? Yeah, those are not cables. Those are cracks in the sidewalk. This is a chalk painting. There's no water here. There's no diving board here. There's no wooden structure here. This is a man standing in the middle of the street, actually. Okay? And those lines are cracks in the paper. Here's another one. Now this one is a little more obvious, I think, because this little beastie down here does, you know, I have a hard time construing that as a real alligator. I don't know why, I mean, you know, it just doesn't seem to fit right for me. So I'm inclined immediately to think, I'm looking at a chalk drawing, another chalk drawing. And in fact, that's what this is. And again, you can see the cracks in the pavement there. Okay. There is no waterfall, there is no water, in fact there's no, what do you call that round rubber thing, is that raft? There's no raft in the picture, okay? You've got a couple of people sitting in the middle of the street. That's what's going on. And what you see here is a drop-off, that doesn't exist, okay? But your mind construes it as actual. Here's another one. I kind of like this. You know, this is a dungeon in the middle of the floor of a large room. Actually, of course, these people up here could have just walked straight across here without falling into the hole, because there's no hole there. There is no rope being let down for somebody to come up on. And here you see some guy who's trying to come up on the rope that's being let down to him by this guy. Well, of course, there's nobody there. In fact, if you look at his face carefully, you'll see it's kind of blank. We tend to construe that as a person, when in fact, if we look carefully, we'll see There's no face. Curious. Now here, you have, it's another chalk painting on the sidewalk. And right up here, you'll see very cleverly done edge to the sidewalk painted. So that it looks like underneath the sidewalk there's a whole other world. And here we've got some guy who's trapped on the ledge of a burning building, and Batman and Robin are coming out to rescue him, and there's a whole batch of people down here watching the rescue. Now actually, if you look carefully at these people over here, you'll see that the mind is fooling you into thinking that there are a batch of people there who are dressed appropriately, etc. Actually, they're not. Most of these people are just little dots. Dots of chalk on the pavement, and the mind constructs them out of whole cloth. If we look over at this one, when I understand like 85% of the people who see this see a young lady with unkempt hair. When I first looked at it, I saw St. George killing the dragon. But some people insist that they see two horses. And I think that they just don't like the concept of a dragon. So they choose to construe it as a couple of horses. Now this is a pretty horse one, you know. Now this is a beautiful example. Because it becomes difficult for the mind to construe this thing. Okay? The question is, where is the floor of this room? Now is it here? I mean, you've got this indication of this guy. Indicates that the floor is here. But if you look at this, the floor must be over here somewhere. And if you look at this guy, the floor is over here somewhere. Okay, he's just coming up from the steps below, from the basement or something. Here, obviously the floor is here. There's no way to put this together. So the mind is baffled by this. And you can't construe it consistently. That way. This is an interesting illusion because actually this area right in here is the same intensity as this area. But most people don't see it that way. In fact, the brain sends signals to the iris to contract the iris because it says that thing is bright. Okay? And people have been able to measure the contraction of the iris from something that doesn't normally, or shouldn't, cause the iris to contract. This is another beautiful example of that. The square A is actually the same color as square B. Why do you think that it isn't? Well, there are two sorts of things going on here, two big cues. One is the checkerboard pattern. We know that when you see a checkerboard pattern, a dark square is surrounded almost entirely by light squares, and a light square is surrounded almost entirely by dark squares. So the pattern tells us if that's a dark square, that has to be a light square. And the mind makes it so. But there's something else going on here. This is a supposedly dark square in a bright light. This is a supposedly light square in the shade. And so the mind lightens it up. Okay, increasing this sense that this one is actually lighter than that. It's not. Now you may wonder, if I am arguing that the concept of God has empirical foundations and relates to our experience, why am I showing all these examples of misperceptions, bad perceptions? Okay, and the reason is, I'm trying to point out that the mind does a lot of this for us, creates what we perceive. And I didn't go into the saccades of the eye. I mean, people who know about that know that when you look at one of these pictures that I had up there, you weren't looking at the whole thing all the time. Your eye movement was moving very rapidly across that. And the brain is configuring it, building up this image, which it keeps before you as if you were looking at the whole thing. You're not. And the movement of the eye is so fast. I've seen an estimate of 1,000 degrees per second. Okay, and that's when it gets really moving. It changes, of course, but if it's really moving, it can approach 1,000 degrees per second. That's almost three times around. In other words, in every second, the eye, if it could, it could completely turn around in your socket three times within a second. And that is going to blur what you see. What you don't see it as blurred. Okay? Not only do you not see it as blurred, not only do you see what appears to be the whole image in front of you, the mind makes up for that hiddenness. It hides that it has hidden. Now here we have a mirror, and if you are looking from here, out this way, you will see what's known as a virtual image of what's over here. So P is some reality, but you'll see something over here as P prime. And if you're a small child or an animal, frequently I've seen pictures, you know, moving pictures of the animal going from here to around the other side of the mirror looking to see where is it. Okay? Because it's very convincing. But what I want to suggest is that if one were to look at this, you could see the same thing here, perhaps, but what if you don't have a concept for it? What if, for example, up here is something like social structure, and you don't have a concept for society and social structure? Then what you may see over here is God. Okay? Or suppose here is conscious, superego, you know, however you want to call it. And you don't have that concept. So as you look into the mirror, you see God. And you think, God is angry at me. When actually what's happened is my superego, my conscious, is growling at me for my misdeeds. Okay? Which I then understand to be, God is angry at me because I did something wrong. So now let's talk about having a reference for God. The term God is a human term. We created it. We apply it or we don't. If we don't choose to apply it, then it becomes meaningless to us or vague to us. And by the way, it strikes me as so incredible that many people try to prove or disprove the existence of God without first figuring out what they mean by God. If I define this projector as God, then there is one. There it is. On the other hand, if I define God as an old man with a white beard that sits on the cloud and pulls a string to make the universe go around, no, there isn't one. So it totally depends on how you understand the concept of God. And I really don't want to get into much detail here. Just the stress, Kant stressed the distinction between the phenomenal and noumenal, and the capacities of the mind determine and contribute to what we can and do experience. Knowledge is limited to the phenomena. And off we go. So what further do we need? Kant's mechanics of the mind were defective, because he simply swallowed a bunch of stuff from Aristotle. And we need a better theory of how construments develop from mental operations. Hawkins provides this. But I don't want to go into much detail on Hawkins, because I've got too much. Jeff Hawkins.
Rich Hawkins.
This book on intelligence. Neurophysiologist. He points out that the cortex is not like a computer. It stores sequences of patterns. It recalls patterns by auto-association. When you perceive something, you sense something, signals are sent into the cortex, and if, for example, you're looking at a dog, and your sequence of signals for dog, I'm going to shorten it and abbreviate it as to a sound called ding, ding, ding. That's, excuse me, that's Rover. Now, when I get this ding, ding, ding signal sent into my cortex, I look around within the cortex automatically and I find, oh, here's ding-ding-dit. Ding-ding-dit means dog. So I recognize it as a dog. So how do you have useful concepts of dog, circle? Is that we have never seen dog. And we have never seen circle. But we have these concepts. Well, every dog is a little different from every other dog, and every time you see the same dog, the experience is a little different than it was last time you saw that dog. So how do you recognize it at all? Well, it helps to have seen a lot of dogs, and cats, and birds, and cows, etc. And then you have some memories, and those are stored in your cortex, and you can then build some similarity relations. So when you get ding-ding-ding, you associate that with ding-ding-dip, and you say, oh, that's this particular dog. Now, when you see another dog, the discharge pattern is somehow similar to what you saw before, and you associate that with dog, not with cat. There is forward and backward processing going on in the cortex. I really don't want to go into this. It's too much detail here. The role of art. Because the presence of choice and the undetermined characteristic of our conclusions, it's becoming evident that life itself is a form of art. We construe our self-concept and the rest of our phenomenal world, even our life, in an artistic way. Science can be helpful, but it too is an art form. It's all based on chosen concepts, which are not forced. So in the rest of the paper, I'm going to present a proposal for the empirical reference for God. And then I will talk a few minutes about ancient antecedents for this. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about scientific study of religion and what kind of support it gives to what I'm saying. And then I'm going to go into Karen Armstrong's book, excuse me, fall through the window, A History of God, for further elucidatory comments. Now, I'm not saying Armstrong agrees with me. What I'm saying is I'm going to illustrate what I'm saying by quoting from a lot of material from Karen Armstrong. So what do we mean by empirical? Well, it has multiple meanings. It has a range of meanings, okay? And so I need to narrow it down a bit. One understanding of empiricism is that knowledge comes only, or primarily, from sense experience. And I'm not pushing for that. Another possible meaning for empiricism, or empirical, is the use of sensory evidence, tests, experiments, should enable us to choose patterns. I do go along with that. There are different degrees of empiricism. Strong empiricism, we only know what comes through our senses, nothing else. This is John Locke, you know, we are all tabula rasa, and experience writes on us. Another possibility is whatever we claim to know should be confirmed or refuted by appeal to our senses. I don't agree with that. Okay? That's too strong. But the last one I do agree with. Whatever patterns we choose should be tied to experiences. And if what we conceive cannot be reconciled with our experience, then there's a problem and we need to look into it. Now, I say that the concept of God is tied to our experiences. And if it weren't so, it would have disappeared. The concept is fundamental to our society, to the way we live, and it's a privileged concept. Much more so than, for example, unicorns, or tooth fairies, Santa Claus, Easter Bunny, Sand. All of these have some empirical foundation. Queen Elizabeth I had the horn of a unicorn in her cabinet of curiosities. Well, it turned out later, people discovered that it wasn't really a unicorn, it was a narwhal. Narwhals are whales that have a horn in the middle of their forehead. Those things exist. Unicorns don't. The Easter Bunny wasn't present in English as an English concept until just before 1700. That's kind of curious. We haven't really become dedicated to the Easter Bunny. There's some interesting stories about why the Easter Bunny lays eggs. It turns out that back in the 1600s in Germany, the Catholics forbid good Catholics from eating eggs during Lent. So at the end of the Lent season, there were a lot of eggs available because nobody told the chickens. And to get rid of these eggs, you know, they started celebrating by having a rabbit lay them around. Okay. I do want to stress that most people have religious experience. Most of the people who are here have had experiences which would qualify as religious experiences. Even if you don't want to call them religious experiences, that's also quite common.
Could you define that? What do you mean by religious experience?
No, I tell you what, on that little paper that I constantly passed around, some of them are out there, there's more definition, and I'll get to that in detail. However, I don't want to at this point. Suffice it to give a single example. If you go to a parade and a group marches by with the American flag and you feel something about it, that's a religious experience. Okay? Yeah. Well, it's more than emotional. It's also intellectual, but it is emotional. And I don't want to go into that aspect of the details.
I needed that definition to be able to follow.
Okay. So those of us who do have religious experiences and who experience some concept of God out of this.
I have a lot of monastic.
Okay. Are familiar with the concept of power. When you look out in the starry heavens and you see all those stars and planets and constellations, etc., and maybe a couple of comets or something, you can perceive perhaps the concept of the great power that has created this. Whether that actually happened or not is irrelevant. Okay, the point is you can experience it. And you can experience it with a sense of awe and power, okay? One can experience a sense of benevolence, or sense some benevolence in your experience. These things on the left are actually empirical experiences. The things on the right are not, the omnis. Because what happens is we take a concept like powerful, which is something we can experience, and we take the limit away from it by a philosophical manipulation, and we end up with an omnipotent, okay? All-powerful, infinitely powerful. Now, if you do that, and then try to apply these things to God, you end up in contradictions, inevitably. For example, if I conceive of, and I'll use a man, because that makes it part of this easier. If I conceive of a man who is omnipotent and indestructible, those are two concepts with the omnis in them. Okay? I can show that that can't be. Because if he's, you know, I raised the question, can he break his own arm? If the answer is yes, then he's not indestructible. If the answer is no, then he's not omnipotent. Okay? So we can't have both. And that's generally true with any two of the omnis. You put two or three of the omnis together and you get a contradiction. But those contradictions do not apply if you stick to empirical experiences. So God is experienced within us, within our physical and biological environment, when I look at the starry heavens above, within our social context, among significant others, and in our culture. And most people in the whole history of the human race have not had the terms to make sense of this. This is the slide that I've sent around, and it's an attempt to diagram what I'm talking about. And my apologies for the fact that you can make a pentacle out of this, which is a symbol of the devil. So, you know, just turn it a little bit, a few degrees, and you get back to God again. There are many, many countries, maybe 30 countries or more, that use a star on their flag as a symbol of their society. And there are a lot of organizations that use stars, particularly military organizations, as a sense of power and so forth. But that's not what I'm talking about here. The idea is that in the middle of this circle is the self. Outside is what is not self. Okay? And the circle represents the horizon of being for any given individual. Okay? Outside that circle, there are all kinds of things which impact upon the individual and which determine that individual. They create, they sustain, they create problems for, etc., that individual. Including internal environment, depth psychology, okay? As I've represented here. That's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm going to go back through these numbers a couple of times here. You'll notice that the internal environment, which is one of the places that we experience God, God is everything out here that impinges upon us in the middle. One of these things is our internal environment, our depth psychology. This is actually an appropriate subject for psychology, medicine, neurophysiology. Our external environment also impinges on us greatly. This is an appropriate subject for physics, chemistry, biology, agriculture, astronomy, etc., biochemistry, whatever. I'm not trying to be inclusive of all the possible sciences on the circle around here. Our society impacts us, and that's an appropriate subject of study for sociology. Significant others impact us, that's an appropriate subject for psychology and sociology. Culture impacts us, and that's an appropriate subject for anthropology. Now, if all of this outside the circle, which impacts us and gives us experiences, is referred to as God, there are a couple of ways that you can approach this study. One is through theology, okay, the study of God, and the other is through all of these sciences. And I maintain they're the same. So theology and science, in all of the sciences, all of its branches, are the same. Most people would find that somewhat startling.
Not all theologies
are the same. That's true. And not all approaches to physics are the same, either. So, anyway, let's proceed. I thought, until recently, that I had invented that diagram. That was my clever thought that put that together. And then a little while ago, I was looking up something on Maat, or Mahat. I really don't know how this is supposed to be pronounced. Any Egyptians with us?
Maat?
Okay, thanks. That's kind of what I thought, but yeah, I have to do something with that apostrophe. Okay. Maat, it turns out, is actually the same thing that I've been talking about. Which surprised me a bit. Because, you know, Maat appears on temple walls from 2500 BC. Okay? Maat is the Egyptian principle of truth, right, good order, cosmic order, justice, law, etc., etc., etc. Okay? And when I saw that, I thought, you know, I know another one. Rita from India. Also very ancient. Same thing. Starts out as a principle, is then personified, and then becomes a deity, a goddess. Okay? And Rita is lawfulness, right order, proper relationship, truth, goodness, etc. Subsequently, Rita shows up in the Vedas a lot. In subsequent writing, Rita is supplanted by a part of Rita, the Dharma, and other possibilities, other certain subsections of Rita. But Rita originally meant basically the same thing as Maat. And guess what? In Zoroastrianism, there's a concept of Sasha, which some people say actually is Rita misspelled. And Asha is subsequently made into the god Ahura Mazda. Okay, it's the same thing. The Dao in China is, you know, the proper way, the truth, righteousness, etc., law and order. Incidentally, in the Tao Te Ching, we come up with this concept of Wu Wei, which was early translated as no action. A French physiocrat, as he called themselves, you know, antecedent of modern economics, was very interested in Chinese Taoism and translated this as no action. And it's thought that perhaps that is the foundation for laissez-faire in modern economics. Interestingly, the same thing is true of the logos concept in Greek. Logos is the truth, the rational aspect of things, etc. This is actually a little more complicated. I won't go into that today. Here's a picture of Mott. This is more recent than the oldest references. You see this feather here, which is also here. Okay? This feather represents truth, and Mott is the Egyptian concept of truth, balance, order, law, morality, justice, order in the heavens, etc. As a deity, she regulates the stars, the seasons, actions of mortals and deities in this life and the next, everywhere, everywhere. Okay, all encompassing. At creation, she set the order of the universe and then she sustains it. The sun god Ra created by setting his daughter Maat in place of chaos. It's interesting, you have here something that starts out as a principle, then becomes personified. It's sort of like the principle of cold weather is nippy, and it becomes personified as Jack Frost, and then, you know, deified. Well, Jack Frost hasn't made it that far, probably won't. But let's go back to this for a second. In all of these cases, you have a principle which is personified, then becomes deified. Now think, what I'm doing is saying, let's go back the other way. Start with a deity, and then end up with it as a principle of order, etc., in the whatever it is that you're experiencing. Okay? Which is appropriately studied by physics, chemistry, psychology, sociology, anthropology, whatever. So let's look at a couple of slides on biblical references. In Genesis, God is the creator and sustainer. God sustains everything. He didn't just create it and leave. He continues to sustain it. So it represents him. He sustains it by himself. Okay? In Exodus, God's name is given as Yahweh, which is the verb to be. And it's been understood by many to imply existence itself, the ground of being, that with which we are ultimately concerned, existence. So when the world exists, it exists by virtue of God. God is the existence that it has.
I thought in Genesis it talked about God says, I am. It doesn't say to be, does it?
Correct. That's an English translation. In Hebrew, it's Yahweh, which is the infinitive to be.
Okay.
Adonai.
Well, Adonai is, of course, what you say instead of saying that if you're an appropriate Jew. I'm not, so. Okay.
I mean, maybe. I'm not either.
And of course, if you take the characters for Yahweh and you put the pointing for Adonai in, you get Jehovah, which is a made-up word that means nothing at all. Or it's the true name of God, depending on, you know, what kind of background you have. In Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, God is the lawgiver and the judge. He's the source of our morality. Okay? Of course, now, if society is the source of our morality, then God and society are the same thing. Psalms 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. So the attributes of God are seen in the environment. In Psalm 50, in Deuteronomy 33, God shines forth from the land. You can see God by looking at the land. Okay? Or he's also present in his people. You can see God looking at the people. In Psalms, Isaiah 63, Jeremiah 2 and 3, Hosea, and many other places, God is spoken of as the father, or a spouse, even as kinsman. And notice, in that diagram, kinsman was number 4, the environment is number 2, this is also number 2, this is number 3, I don't know what, this might be number 1. So, the same concepts that I just went over and put in a diagrammatic form are present in the Old Testament. They're also present in the New Testament. John 1, the first chapter of the Gospel according to John, Jesus is the Logos incarnate, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God, and is God. Nothing was created that was not created by him. All things were created by him. Okay, the Logos, which, by the way, equals God, which equals mod. Okay? The Logos is the rational character of everything, and that rational character is God. So God is the rational character in everything. In John 8, Jesus is speaking with his Jewish critics, and he says, I came from God. You're of your father, the devil. What he's saying is, there's something within individuals which forms them, guides their perceptions and their actions. These people just don't get what he's saying because they are manifesting the devil that is within them instead of the God which is in him. Right. Okay. In Acts 17, Paul, on his way to Athens, passes by a shrine to the unknown God and decides that he's going to preach about the unknown God. And so he tells the folks in Athens, in him we live and move and have our being. We are his offspring. So God is the environment that shapes our lives, our activities, our very essence. I have a feeling that Paul and I could really hit it off together. Ephesians 6, Paul says, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers of the air. Devils, like deities, are not a type of being. Okay? They are characteristics of our environment. Principalities, powers. Okay? I'm sure he would say exactly the same thing about the rules of the U.S. Senate. Principalities and powers which create all kinds of problems for us. In the first epistle of John, fourth chapter, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God, and God in him. Now, logically, this means God equals love. God is relationship to others. This slide is difficult. What I'm trying to point out is that there is a development in concepts over here, and another development in concepts over here, and they are not synchronous. They're just slightly synchronous. Okay? What was known as philosophy became subsequently known, at least part of it, as natural philosophy. That didn't happen all at once. Aristotle uses the phrase natural philosophy, but 99.9% of folks in medieval Europe didn't know that. For them, they just talked about philosophy, okay? If they got that far. In about 1800s or so, we started hearing about natural science, which replaced the term natural philosophy. When Newton wrote his Principia, it was the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. Basically physics, okay, but he called it natural philosophy. this is a relatively recent term. It's ancient in the sense of a body of knowledge. For example, theology is a, wood carving is a body of knowledge, okay, a science in that sense. But as a something which is set apart with a different method, that's very new. This term scientist, for example, didn't really get into common use until in the 1900s. The first usage of this in English was by William Yule, who said, you know, we've got people who are practitioners of the various sciences, and I suggest that we need a word to describe those people. I suggest scientist. And that was, according to my copy of the OED, 1840, but I've seen 1834 as well. It didn't catch on. In 1890, somebody else suggested we should call those people scientitians. And that's even worse. So eventually, science has caught on. Over here we have a similar development going on. God is spoken of early on, and then people who don't want to use the term God start talking about nature, and there's also the development of the concept of human nature, but Hobbes, for example, who uses the concept of human nature, is very quickly critiqued by Rousseau, Voltaire, and Hume, who say, no, this is not a constant thing, we need to talk about something else. And culture didn't come into English usage as it does, as it means now, in anything like what it means now, until 1870, in a voluminous attempt by Edward James, I guess, on the history of religions. Now, an example of some of this transition can be seen in the six editions of Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments from 1759 to 1790. I like this. I brought along my copy. Now, these critical texts, all six editions are here, not one after the other, just in footnotes. You've got one continuous stream, but some of it is footnoted and said this piece was moved from here to there, this piece was excised, and then you've got in the back this critical apparatus that tells you all the changes in spelling and so forth. And one of the things that you can see from this is that Adam Smith starts out frequently saying things like, God has provided man with this internal critic, the little man within who criticizes his actions. Okay? Subsequently, he drops that kind of talk, and he switches to nature has provided man with this internal critic. So, if Adam Smith can do it, so can I. Okay? So let's talk about the scientific study of religion a bit. I'm going to look in the areas, number one, internal to oneself, number three, internal to society, and number five, internal to one's culture. Freud, example number one, Freud regards religion as false and illusory, but those are not the same. By illusory, he means fulfilling wishes. And wish fulfillment is not necessarily false. He gives as an example the young lady who is looking to marry the Prince Charming. She may succeed, or at least within her own concept, she may succeed. Okay? So you can't say that because it's illusory, it's false. It might be true. In any case, religion is useful as wish fulfillment and as restraint on human instincts toward incest, cannibalism, lust for killing, to combat laziness, etc. He had a rather dark picture of mankind. And that makes sense because he was writing between world wars. Most of what he wrote was written in that period between the First World War and the Second World War, and it was written in Europe. He saw this stuff. And it was, pretty brutal. Humans seek to maximize pleasure while minimizing suffering. And how do we do that? Well, we have a couple of tools. We have civilization, which nowadays, what he called civilization, we call culture. And we have religion, which supports civilization and culture by restraining our negative impulses. But when we do restrain these negative impulses, this creates displeasure. So civilization is discontents. They're discontent because they're civilized. Okay? And they cannot, with their civilization and their religious support for this, handle their own painful mortal existence, the cruel and destructive aspects of the natural world, and the necessary sacrifices in order to live with other people. While the love instinct can be used to bind society together, the aggressive instinct has to be repressed or redirected toward other societies. Religion is great for that. You know, it's us and them, kill them. repressed instinctive drives tend to show up as guilt or anxiety or neurosis, and religion attempts to deal with these by explaining evil and providing forgiveness. And by the way, this works for some people. It resolves their internal and external conflicts, integrates their personalities, optimizes their relationships, and they live a better life. But, actually, the majority are left in a childish state of subservience to myth. Okay? Now, Jung took a little more advanced stance. Jung, by the way, did not believe in God. Okay? But he said the gods are archetypes from the collective unconsciousness. So when he was reproached, he said, well, I don't have to believe in God. I know there's a God. Lots of them. And when these archetypes are projected, they lose power. And somewhere, I couldn't find exactly where I went back looking for it. Most of his patients, he said, suffered from losing contact with these gods. So what you need to do is, in psychoanalysis, show them where, you know, there is this concept that's available to them and get them back in touch with what goes on at the very depths of their being. So all of the psychoanalysts agree that the psychoanalysis might be a better way than religion, and thus, because it's expensive, psychoanalysis is a rich man's religion, or religion is a poor man's psychoanalysis. Hawkins, whom I skipped over at the early part, and Bruce and others have said, you know, by the way, we think we've experienced something that we haven't, quite frequently. These things like gravity, life, dog, God, we don't directly experience them. We experience things falling, but we don't experience gravity. We experience live bodies, but not life. We experience dogs, but not dog. We experience instances of social suasion, but not God. Nonetheless, all of these concepts are useful in talking about the experiences that we do have. They are tied to our experiences. In every case, the abstract noun on the right is taken as a noun for one or more perceived patterns. If we don't have abstract nouns like society or culture, the term God is very useful. So God is a construment, a chosen concept used to refer to empirical aspects of our experience. And we've all experienced the feeling that someone or something, either within or outside, wants us to do something. Frequently, people attribute this to God. Hawkins and Hood have shown that we have the concept of agency available to us, even when we haven't seen the agent. So if the rains wash out our path, if the crocodile eats the mailman, if a tornado tears off the roof of the house, surely that's an act of God. And who is it that insists that I pay attention to my neighbor's needs? I don't want to. But somebody's telling me I have to. Who suggested I root for the home team when I don't know any of the players? Who convinces me to make a contribution to my church or in United Way? Why do I stop at a red light when nobody else is there? Okay. Well, yeah, we could say social constraint, learned habits, etc. It's easier to say God told me to. Why do I keep my promises? Why do I care what happens to others? God. Durkheim is a fundamental sociologist from my perspective, did this study on elementary forms of religious life. and concluded that religion is what holds society together. God is society writ large. That's a direct quote from him. It is society's way of representing itself to itself. The believer's self-image depends on God. The totemist knows that the totem represents God. He also knows, although he might not be able to say it, that it represents his society. So consequently, if the totem represents God and the totem represents his society, God equals society. He may have another totem for himself, or he might not. He might use the same. In which case, we're demonstrating that God, society, determines his self-image of himself. Religion reflects society's collective aspects. Every society can be called religious because if a society lacked collective ways of thinking and acting, it wouldn't be a society. If we feel dependent on God, that's just a symbolic representation of our dependency on society. If we tremble at God's justice and punishment, that's our regard for society's laws. Our reverence for divinity is but our respect for society. Our belief in the immortality of the soul is our belief in the continuity of the collective life. And these concepts are protected and existentially vital. They're protected because they're vital to the maintenance of society, the collective life of the group, which is why an atheist can never be elected president of the United States. Okay, because atheists are all antisocial. against society. Okay? Now, you know, I know this isn't so, but that is the common perception. This, by the way, is why the early Christians were thrown into the pens with the animals to be eaten, because they were atheists. They did not support the religion of the society. They refused to bow down to the emperor. Okay, so these are protected concepts. Durkheim's definition of religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things. What is a sacred thing? Things set apart, surrounded by prohibitions. And these prohibitions are beliefs and practices that unite its adherents into a single moral community, which is a church or a society. Okay. Guy Swanson found that belief in gods was universal in societies with three or more levels of sovereignty. I won't go into what that is. Section 5, dealing with culture. Evans Pritchard argued that the religion of the Azanda, primarily witchcraft and oracles, can be understood in its social context and function, and its function is basically solving disputes. Azanda faith in witchcraft and oracles is quite logical and consistent once some fundamental tenets are accepted. Most of us won't accept those tenets, but okay, if you did, it would be quite reasonable. Loss of faith cannot be endured because of the social importance of these concepts. Hence, they had an elaborate system of explanations or excuses against disproving evidence. Besides, Evans Pritchard pointed out, there isn't any alternative terms or school of thought. Clifford Geertz, culture is also, religion is a system of symbols. Culture is also a system of symbols. So religion is a form of culture. And one of the most important symbols is God. I'm going to buzz on a little bit here. So looking at the human sciences, we've seen psychologists discussing the way God can be used to deal with the problems of self, immigration, and death psychology. Sociologists saying God is society writ large. Anthropologists saying God is a protected concept because it's used to support culture, of which it's a part. And I'm saying God as the horizon of being, or that just beyond the horizon, which impacts us at the horizon, is that which with which we deal in these sciences. Now, I've got a batch of things taken from Karen Armstrong's book, mostly. This one is something that came out of Newsweek or Time magazine, I'm not sure which, late 60s, commenting on growing opposition to the war. Up there at the top, a lay preacher said, God seems to have changed his mind about the Vietnam War. Nowadays, you hardly talk to anyone who favors it. Now, this is a beautiful example of biblical parallelism. Okay, the saying is the same thing in two different ways. If you ask, well, how do you know that God changed his mind? Well, nowadays, you hardly talk to anybody who favors him. So obviously, God has changed his mind. The implication of this is that the people I talk to are God. In other words, the significant others. So how far is it from seeing God as a father, a spouse, a kinsman, to seeing our significant others as part of God? I say, not very far at all. That's number four on that chart. Number one, God within us. Let's see. The rabbis insisted because each of the prophets had a different personality. It influenced his conception of the divine. So we see the same thing happening in other monotheistic traditions. And to this day, theological ideas about God are very private matters in Judaism and not enforced by the establishment. And you'll see the same thing in Christianity to a significant extent. There was a Gnostic tradition, which was even more so that way, but it got killed by Constantine, who wanted one Christian tradition. But Christian mysticism survived. Augustine found God by looking within in his own psyche. He even found models of the Trinity in his mental capacities, which he took to be part of the image of God within himself. And Ignatius Loyola developed spiritual exercises, which are a crash course in mysticism, and still used by some Catholics and Anglicans as an alternative to psychotherapy. Sufism, the same thing, internal aspect of Islam. Many are quoted saying things like, I am God, the Father and I are one, I am the truth. Okay, these are all mystical expressions. And if you said too many of them at the wrong time in the history of Islam, you ended up dead. However, some of the greats, such as Al-Ghazali, found this was really the only way to understand God. He made Sufism acceptable to the establishment and had shown that it was the most authentic form of Muslim spirituality, and for many Muslims it still is. So how far is it from saying that each man experiences God differently, depending on the inner workings of his own mind, to saying that part of what one experiences in experiencing God is the deep and inner workings of his own mind? I claim that's not a big step at all. Now, God is also immanent in the community. This for the Jews, whenever they got together to study the Torah, the Shekinah sat among them. This is the glory of the Lord. And Christians, look at Augustine here. Let us rejoice then and give thanks that we have become not only Christians, but Christ himself. Do you understand and grasp, brethren, God's grace toward us? Marvel and rejoice, we have become Christ. So how far is it from saying that God is immanent in the community to saying that part of the perception of God is the perception of the community or the society? And now, you know, I do something similar with the environment. The universe itself is God. The Logos is present in all that is. Spinoza and Leibniz are pantheists. Tillich says God's the ground of all being. How far is it from saying that all we can see is God, or the face of God, to saying God is all that we can see? Not very far at all. Okay, and then in the fifth section, God and culture. Moses, Jesus, Muhammad all split our calendars and inaugurated cultures. Armstrong points out that the Western Roman Empire began to fall. As it did, the Christian concept of God became darker and more defensive, page 123. At the fall of Constantinople and the start of the Renaissance, this is late 1400s and beyond, all the major monotheisms were experiencing change. By the end of the 16th century, the West was about to create an entirely different type of culture. And what she's talking about is the onset of the Reformation. Okay, and she says this was even more evident in Calvinism than in Lutheranism, in which Max Weber agrees in his book, The Cause and Ethics in the Spirit of Capitalism. Before Muhammad, Arabic culture was tribal, polytheistic, individualist, brutal, valued wealth, power, and fame. Muhammad knew that monotheism was inimical to tribalism.
A single deity would integrate society as well as the individual. Okay, Armstrong points out that the pillars of Islam consciously create a new culture. In practical terms, Islam, which means subordination, surrender, meant that Muslims had a duty to create a just, equitable society where the poor and vulnerable are treated decently. The early message of the Quran is simple. It's wrong to stockpile wealth and to build a private fortune. It's good to share the wealth, giving a regular proportion of one's wealth to the poor. So how far is it from saying that a new vision of God produces a new culture to saying that culture is part of the vision of God? I say it's not very far at all. Two last slides. Aeschylus, these are his dates, a Greek dramatist. This is a scene depicting the return of Agamemnon. And in Aeschylus's play, Agamemnon, by the way, that's, I guess, Agamemnon with his head down, because it's a very sad time. Aeschylus says, "He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart." And in our own despite, Robert Kennedy translated this, "Until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God."
By Robert Sweet.
Yeah, how far is it from saying that the prophet and mystic has a direct intuitive knowledge of God, which is derived more from the imagination? This is what Karen Armstrong says. Than from the intellect, to saying that the prophet imagines a construment of God or imaginatively utilizes the God symbol. That's it.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have about 2 minutes or so for questions. So we'd like to start off.
Ed, this was a very fine presentation, full of educational nuances. It was also, I think, perhaps the best argument I have ever heard for atheism.
You know, I don't really see that it matters that much whether one is a theist or an atheist.
Well, you can't be president.
Can't be, oh, I...
can't be what?
President. Right. Oh, right. Yeah, I'm going to let you turn that thing off. I guess I've gotten to the point where I see theism as simply the choice to use the concept of God, where atheism is the choice not to use the concept of God. They should be compatible. In other words, the theist needs to pay attention to what the modern sciences are saying. But also, the atheist needs to pay attention to what the theist is saying, in part because there's so many of them, in part because there is a big tradition here, an ancient tradition. And any tradition that has been around for thousands of years deserves a certain amount of respect.
Why? Yeah.
Well, because, if you don't follow what's being said, you don't understand your own history. And if you don't understand your own history, you have no past. And if you don't have a past, you have no future. So, I see it as very valuable for individuals who are non-theist or atheist to try and make sense out of what the theists are saying and have said.
Jason?
Well, that's different than...
It's on my slide.
Where...
What?
To try to make sense of where it all comes from.
Yes.
Is one thing.
I'm not saying that the atheist should believe in God. I'm just saying he needs to understand what the theist is saying.
Okay, Jason.
Would you concede any utility to the human tendency to personify and deify principles, or is this something that we should have outgrown by?
You know, when you look at something like Jack Frost, personification of damage done to human noses and cheeks, etc.,
and fingers by cold. That principle has been personified. I don't really see a problem with that, as long as you know that there isn't this little, you know, sprite that's running around biting people, literally.
Jack?
Yes, I'll make a comment and then I'll ask a question. I wish you would have just said one other thing that Durkheim said, which was, we just made it all on it. But anyway.
Well, that's construmentalist.
Right, that's what it is. But you know, sometimes when you put things in a very common language, it maybe resonates with some people differently. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just kind of figure that in the world today, as we are becoming, the Earth is getting more populated, we are I think God is becoming a lot more fragmented. Or I was wondering if you see that in the fact that, like in the United States, we're becoming more polarized, there's no unified point of view. We have different groups, sciences, whatever, coming up with different discoveries or ideas or thoughts. So, I mean, what it seems like is that either God's got to become some bigger concept or it's changing. What, I mean, I don't know if that's a great question or not. But
let me comment on it. 200 years ago, the idea that science and religion were in conflict was a rare idea. Most people didn't see that at all. I mean, there were examples like Galileo, etc., and the caution of some people like Newton, who didn't want to say certain things. Okay, but not so much that they saw religion and science in conflict as they saw their particular point of view and the dominant religion as being in conflict. That science and religion should be in conflict just didn't really occur to people until relatively recently. But you see the same thing going on in the sciences. The sciences, you know, first we have a relatively limited set of sciences, and then we get more and more and more, and we get specialized groups who only talk to people who use their terminology to talk about a specific subsection of neurophysiology.
Is there
or whatever.
A difficulty with, at least with the established religions in the sense that, you know, that all major religions have their sacred texts. And their sacred text was, most of them were written a long time ago in a specific culture. And as we gain more and more experience and knowledge, there are some people who say that those texts are no longer applicable.
Yeah, this is a real problem. Because the thing is, interesting things, when you look at the people who wrote those texts, like Paul, for example, he was perfectly happy to take current events, you know, and use them as his springboard. On the way here, I passed the shrine to the unknown God. Let me tell you about the unknown God. In him we live and move and have our being. Or, you know, the author of the Gospel of John, who said, you know, picks up from Philo. Philo said that the Logos was the firstborn of God. Okay? So you have that showing up in the New Testament. All kinds of, you know, current philosophy and science, such as it was, is picked up by these people who write these books. It's only the people who you know, sanctify them that don't.
I'm sorry. But
I'm
agreeing. I like what his comments are. I was just going to make one other comment. Is that, you know, we have statements like love your neighbor as yourself, which is a principle, and obviously today we have a lot less of that.
I don't know.
We have questions, gentlemen.
I can't answer that one.
We have questions, gentlemen, in the corner.
On the one hand, your argument seems to be the postmodern argument that says everything's just a narrative. So the atheist has his narrative, and the theist has his narrative. And then on the other hand, it sounds like American pragmatism, something like William James, that says whatever works for you is the truth in matters of which we can have no certainty. Is that basically the crux of what you're saying? That we have two different narratives, but neither of the narratives is absolutely true. And on the other hand, since we only have these two narratives, choose the one that works best for you.
Yeah, I go along with that.
Okay, we have time for two more questions.
Ed. I think we have more than two, but that's, yeah. That's fine.
Well, right. I'll comment on the last question. Yeah, I think there's a little bit of difference there between you have your narrative and I have my narrative.
Well, yeah, I'm not
a popular song talked about I live in a two-story house. You have your story and I have my story.
Mm. They lead to divorce. But if
no,
the two are in
wait till I finish my comment, please. I speak in paragraphs, not sentences.
Okay.
But the point is that we need to learn to speak to one another in understanding the different narratives that we have. Not that we get to choose narratives. That's inevitable. But we have to speak to each other knowing that there's a different narrative. Now, to move on to this, I want to point out something, which is, of all the little quibbles I wrote down here, I think the main thing that focuses a question is, what's the difference between Santa Claus and God? They're both personifications. They both have rather remarkable powers, but we do not go to war over Santa Claus, or do it rarely. We go to war constantly over God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we look far back in the history that you gave of all of this development of God, after the personifications and before monotheism, there was a considerable amount of peace in the Mediterranean world. It was the Jews who said, our God or the highway. It was the Christians who said, it's the Jewish God, my way or the highway. And ever since, God has been a tool for disagreeing with one another, not for communicating with one another. And that is the principal force that God has in our culture.
Let me comment on this. If you look at Jung, Carl Jung, basically he's an atheist, okay? But he made use of the term God. And he did it quite well. And a lot of people never figured out where he stood. Okay? If you look at that quote that I ended with from Aeschylus, he was an atheist. Okay? 500 BC. But he used the term God. And he used it effectively. He knew how to use it. And that's what I'm recommending. That we ought to know how to use the term. And make good use of it when it's the simplest term for our use, when it's appropriate for the content of people we're talking to, whatever it is. That makes good sense to use the term God, because it does in fact have meaning, and it has meaning for a lot of people. Now, are there divisions? Of course there are divisions. But within a community, there tends to be a fair amount of concurrence in whether or not one should use the term God within, you know, the Baptist Church or the Episcopalian Church or the Catholic Church, you know, within those groups, there is a certain degree of unanimity. Not full, but, and you'll find people who are very critical of what somebody else says, yeah. This may be a personality problem. I'm trying to get beyond that and talk in terms of, you know, how we can speak so as to be understood, and how we can hear what somebody else is saying so as to understand what they're saying.
We have one last question, and then we've got to close. Ray?
Yeah, in my view, I bring it all down to the evolutionary advantage of religion. What does it do in propagating our species? In fact, until we had dogs in the archaeological record, we had no gods. And it's a function, it seems, of symbiosis in the same way that if you divide the world into major crops and then you divide the world into major religions, you have the same path. Whereas Jesus said, God is grapes and wheat. Or as Apollo and the original Jesus, the son of Zeus before him, said the same thing. Or Horus said it before him. But without understanding the biology of religion, how can we even attempt to, is all theology, without the biology, all theology is just literary criticism. And, you know, as I used to tell my ex-wife school teacher, you know, the Chinese are kicking our butts, the Indians are kicking our butts, you know, because they are studying science and you're telling your children, let's read fiction. And she spent hours and hours complaining about No Child Left Behind because it didn't have a place for her literary criticism. And I think that's what we're looking at here. Is religion a detriment to us now? And how, and what defines what which theology is right? At the current rate of growth, Mormonism will be the number one religion in the world within 100 years. Is this, you know, apparently, yes, apparently we can't have an atheist, but we can have a Mormon as president.
All right. Yeah, let's not let him address.
Okay. By the way, Ray, a month ago we had Cone here speaking to us, and he used the phrase that God is the source of our morality. And you said, well, if so, then God is grapes and grain. And I was sitting in the, you know, the audience saying, amen, amen. You'll notice on that slide, the one that I passed around, agriculture is prominently featured as part of God. It's the study of God. Grapes and grain is, you know, significant. I think you're right on. You may have meant it as a reductio ad absurdum.
And
the fact is that, you know, we do have fundamentalist, absolutist tendencies within large parts of the society, and these create problems for us. But we cannot address them effectively if what we say is, there is no God. I'm right, I got it. We have to be a little more subtle.
Let's give a round of applause for our speaker.